to author Gretchen Rubin about her latest book, Better Than Before, Mastering the Habits of Our Everyday Lives. You've been listening to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Stay tuned for the rest of the Monday morning radio zine.
KBOO is proud to present a live broadcast of the Inner City Blues Festival, a benefit for Healthcare for All Oregon from the North Portland Eagles Lodge, 7611 North Exeter at North Lombard in Portland, Saturday, April 11th from 6 p.m. to midnight. Hear live performances from such local blues and R&B luminaries as LaRonda Steele, Norman Sylvester Band, and many more. Again, that's the Inner City Blues Festival live broadcast and show on Saturday, April 11th from 6 p.m. to midnight. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Tuesdays, 4 to 5 p.m. Eastern, on Pacifica Affiliates WXOJLPFM, Northampton, Massachusetts, and KWMD in Kasilof and Anchorage, Alaska. Produced by Freedom Center and the Icarus Project, streaming, podcasting, and archived at madnessradio.net. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, our guest is Christopher Lane. Christopher is the author of Shyness, How Normal Behavior Became a Sickness. He is the Pierce Miller Research Professor of Literature at Northwestern University, and he's the author of several books, including the co-editor of Homosexuality and Psychoanalysis, and the editor of Psychoanalysis of Race. So welcome to Madness Radio, Christopher Lane.
Thanks so much.
Now, you've written a really interesting book about shyness and the promotion of disease by pharmaceutical industry and psychiatry, and it's getting a lot of attention in the media, and it's really opened up a big discussion. It's a really interesting book. I really encourage people to check it out. How did you get interested in the question of shyness and psychiatric disorders? You have a background as a literature professor, is that right?
That's correct. And I'm also a teacher, and many of the kids that I teach are on some kind of medication. I wanted to know why they and their psychiatrists felt that meds were necessary for relatively mild problems, in fact, that earlier generations had dealt with quite differently. And that's how I got interested in the question of shyness. But I'd also written a book on how the Victorians thought about antisocial behavior in general. And when I thought about writing a sequel to that book, I interviewed a number of psychiatrists today and asked them, what do you think would have happened if misanthropes from the Victorian era were born today? Would they be medicated? And most of them said yes, they probably would be. And so the question for me was whether medication was being used to eliminate really a huge range of emotions along with the suffering that they're supposed to counter. What I was interested in was sort of the unforeseen effects of all of this massive increase in diagnosis of anxiety disorders and psychiatric disorders in general. And that's what led me really to the American Psychiatric Association archives. What I wanted to do was determine exactly why 112 new psychiatric disorders were added to the third edition of that Diagnostic Bible in 1980. And so I was able to put together the backstory, which is completely fascinating, based on all the memos and the votes the documents that had circulated behind the scenes that no one really had seen or written about, but the statute of limitations on them had expired quite recently, and so I was able to review them and copy them, and it was quite disturbing to what I saw.
Now, this is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is kind of the Bible of mental illness and psychiatry. It's sort of a listing of all the different disorders, and it guides professionals on how to make a diagnosis and how to say that someone has this mental illness, that they have this disease, based on all these different criteria.
That's right. And it's the experts really right across the mental health or the health professions. I mean, you're looking at school counselors, you're looking at prisons, at courts, obviously the whole psychiatric and medical profession. So it's really an incredibly influential document. That's why its nickname is the Diagnostic Bible. And really not just in this country, but around the world. A few adjustments in phrasing or new criteria or certainly new disorders begin to be picked up in other countries that take the manual extremely seriously and in fact invoke it chapter and verse. So what happens here in Washington with the next edition of the DSM will really have a ripple effect on diagnostic rates of mental health really around the world.
So you were able to go into the archives, and with your approach of being a literary of being a literature professor and taking a really close look at the documents behind the DSM, mm-hmm. you're really able to look at its internal workings. What kinds of things did you discover when you did that?
Well, maybe the most extreme was a proposal for something called chronic complaint disorder, which aimed to pathologize people who grumble about the weather, the energy crisis, and taxes, and even racetrack results. And the author wrote that the person with this disorder would say, oy vey, a little too often. And this is a quote, inflict their persistent and consistent complaining in a high-pitched whining fashion, which is especially noxious to the listener. And that was an extreme, and fortunately they were wise enough not to approve that one. But other proposals were for a chronic undifferentiated unhappiness disorder. And then there were the 112 new disorders that were approved, including social phobia, which included symptoms such as fear of eating alone in restaurants, concern about hand trembling when one is writing a check, and avoidance of public toilets, restrooms. Those criteria are still in the DSM. But what I also found first, the slant toward biomedical explanations for suffering within American psychiatry. The task force was composed entirely of people who focused on neuropsychiatric and biomedical explanations for suffering. They actually met for 4 years before it even occurred to them to include people from other branches of psychiatry. So it was really tilted toward an outcome that the people were already predisposed to. And then as Isaac Marks put it to me, he's a world-renowned expert on anxiety, emeritus now at the University of London, the consensus was arranged by leaving out the dissenters. So basically those who disagreed with the approval of the new disorders, one of the key ones was whether panic should be renamed panic disorder, and that was at a conference that was sponsored by the pharmaceutical company Upjohn. Isaac Marks said he basically was not invited to subsequent meetings. He'd made his dissent clear, but it was never registered formally, and so people went ahead with the new disorder and with dozens of other ones, basically accepting only the input of those who agreed that these were new psychiatric conditions. And they had a big fight over premenstrual dysphoric disorder, which still officially is in the appendix to DSM-4, although it has its own diagnostic code, which means that that, you know, physicians and psychiatrists can prescribe Sarafem, which is basically a lavender-colored version of Prozac. It's maybe one or two molecules different, but it's still the antidepressant that's been repackaged for premenstrual dysphoric disorder. And of course, there was, you know, millions of dollars were spent in advertising to promote that disorder, but people were extremely unhappy about it, still are. There were resignations from the major committees over those discussions. But that's a clear case where the drug company was pressing for the new disorder because it could extend its patent on Prozac if it relabeled the drug is Sarafem.
Now, tell us about shyness, because I know that social anxiety disorder is sort of the case study that your book looks at in depth to really reveal these dynamics that are going on in all the diagnoses.
Shyness is an extremely common personality trait or behavioral trait. There's really a 50% chance that your listeners will consider themselves shy or will identify as such. What I found with the backstory of DSM-3 was that basically the symptoms for social phobia overlap so magnificently with shyness that they're almost interchangeable. And particularly with the approval of avoidant personality disorder too, part of the discussion of that centered on whether people took their cars to work or preferred public transportation, and quite serious. That was part of the so-called sort of scientific discussion.
In terms of deciding whether people were shy or whether they could be in public or whether they needed to be in their cars.
Exactly, and whether taking a car was then a sign that you were avoiding other people, or whether it was just simply more convenient because you had a bad commute on public transportation and you needed a more direct route. I mean, it just astonishing that obvious things like that didn't seem to occur to them. I mean, it's mind-boggling. But at any rate, the psychiatrists themselves were so concerned about the overlap with shyness that they put in a paragraph on DSM-4 saying, physicians beware, like try not to confuse the two things. But there's a vast psychiatric literature that basically acknowledges it's very hard to tell them apart. And increasingly, with the new editions of the DSM coming out in 1987 and then again in 1994, the threshold for diagnosis was lowered quite dramatically. So that, I mean, new things were added, such as public speaking anxiety, so that and people who felt anticipated anxiety about saying the wrong thing or acting in a way that could be construed as embarrassing. I mean, this is literally in the DSM, and so that's why they included that caveat, please try not to confuse it with shyness. But in fact, the whole basis of the disorder is that it totally overlaps with that very, very common behavioral trait. What we found with GlaxoSmithKline was they found the criteria for the disorder so malleable that they could in fact press for diagnosis by encouraging people to relabel their shyness social anxiety disorder. And they spent over $93 million in 1 year on a public awareness campaign for the disorder, not for the drug. They wanted people to second-guess themselves, to question whether their ordinary shyness was in fact something more serious. And this is what the drug companies do all the time, particularly with the increase of direct-to-consumer advertising. They put the questionnaires up on the web. They distribute the literature, the brochures, where people can sort of tick off on a small scale, 1 to 5, normally, you know, are you anxious about people in authority? Do you dislike going to parties alone? And other factors like this, do you dislike speaking in front of your colleagues at work? And if you have enough ticks or enough high numbers, you can then go to your doctor and say, hey, it looks as if this is me. This is what I'm suffering from. And what your listeners will also know, they'll recognize from all the ads in magazines and on the radio and on TV, is that the drug companies are trying to link bipolar disorder with depression so that they can meet both markets, and so that they encourage people to say, you know, when you're down in terms of bipolar disorder, it's not part of that disorder. It's actually a symptom of depression, a second one, and therefore this is the drug that will meet both problem. And the shift towards neuroleptics or antipsychotics is very cynical, I think. It's entirely due to the fact that these are still on patent. And it's also, we're finding out just how cynical from revelations about, say, Joseph Biederman at Harvard Medical School, the man responsible really for putting two-year-olds on these drugs, where so many young children have died. Over 955 had a Massachusetts general were taking that drug after Rebecca Riley died from it, age four. And you have to ask yourself, you know, what is a four-year-old doing being prescribed this very dangerous drug? It's never been approved for the treatment of childhood bipolar disorder. How do we really know that bipolar disorder is an affliction affecting a two-year-old or a three- or four-year-old when children cycle through so many moods and phases in the course of normal development? I think it's a very dangerous path that the psychiatric profession and the drug companies decided to take.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio. We're speaking with Christopher Lane, who is the author of Shyness, How Normal Behavior Became a Sickness. What were some of the other things that you discovered in your research around shyness and how it was being marketed?
Shyness in particular was being included through a public awareness campaign that was called Imagine Being Allergic to Other People, which is a very extreme way of putting the problem. But it was basically a picture of a relatively young man staring into a teacup. The text below it was a series of statements about how isolated he felt, how alone, how difficult he experienced interactions with other people. And then there was a 1-800 number for people to call. And the drug company which had paid for it, this is GlaxoSmithKline, had none of its fingerprints on there. I mean, it took a number of investigative journalists to find out that behind the scenes, they had been sponsoring a group called Freedom From Fear, which is mentioned on the campaign, and that this was part of the public relations campaign that was set up through Conan Wolf, the Madison Avenue-based PR company, which has, you know, clients from Visa to Hilton Hotels. I mean, they're really adept at pushing a message. And in particular, they're very good at masking negative data. And
so GSK, GlaxoSmithKline, was really posing as a charity, and it actually was a public relations campaign.
Absolutely, and this is what they do in terms of support groups, too. Patient support groups, of 2/3 of them are funded by the drug companies. And what they then encourage is for various active, often photogenic members of those groups to address the media, to say, this is my problem. And any naysayer or dissenter has to then deal with this sort of vociferous argument from these paid consultants who are then saying, you know, you are denying my suffering, you are minimizing a very serious condition, I have social anxiety disorder. And when it's rebuked by people saying the DSM lists sort of fear of using public restrooms and concern about hand trembling when you're writing a check, that's beside the point, because I have low serotonin, and that's the reason why I have social anxiety disorder. I mean, they're very much sponsored to rebut criticism of the process. Well, I think the question here is how much hype and spin is given to the problem. So it's so often over dramatized and made to seem far more extreme than it is. Obviously, some people chafe when they hear that they've maybe bought into a certain perception the economics of it, though, are very real. At the same time, I was fascinated in writing the book by the kind of comfort that is gained from these abstract terms, because they're often very reassuring to people, in part because the language of a disorder references the brain, the implication that one has a chemical imbalance. It is also very impersonal. It implies that there's some abstract problem that medication can fix, and therefore it's not tied to anything like environment or peer pressure or cultural influences and social effects and so on, even generational shifts in the way we think about behavior, which is so crucial to thinking about this. And since obviously shyness in the 50s. Was often prized as a virtue, or was seen as appropriate bashfulness and modesty. I don't want to sort of idealize that condition. There were all kinds of associated problems with it, particularly for women. But there's been a massive shift in the way that we think about these behaviors. What I found, though, is that the defensiveness is in part attached to the very abstractness of the idea that this disorder is to do with brain chemistry and nothing more. Of course, it's a very oversimplified way of thinking about the brain, which is formidably complicated. And what we know from research is that low serotonin is not a predictor of depression or anxiety. You can have people with low serotonin who experience no depression. You can have people with high levels of serotonin who do. And so the relationship or the causal idea of it is it has not been proven, which means that those who are continuing to peddle that idea are, I think, being intellectually dishonest. But we do need to think about the comfort that is gained from these labels, and also the fact that there is real suffering here. And I'm not, as I'm sometimes accused of, saying, you know, shyness, social anxiety is simply a social construction, and therefore suffering too is something that's by implication fabricated. No, suffering is real, but the question is how we interpret it. The question is whether we construe that it's a mental psychiatric condition, or whether it's a relatively benign behavioral trait that some people enjoy, some people prize as a kind of eccentricity or quirk, or simply a feature of their personality, and other people do find more limiting. But then there are a huge number of non-psychiatric ways of addressing that.
Now, tell us a little bit about the DSM-5, and I know that there are a number of new disorders that are on their way, as well as this whole question of secrecy and how confidential the process should be, because, I mean, it's a scientific process. Science is based on openness and peer review and looking at the results, but there's this whole question of secrecy in the creation of the new DSM.
The new disorders being considered, they are being discussed, so there's no guarantee that they'll make their way in. Apathy as a disorder, overuse of the internet, extreme shopping or compulsive buying disorder, sexual addiction, what they call parental alienation syndrome. There's been a lot of discussion also about something called relational disorder, which is extraordinarily difficult to define, as you might guess, or to set a limit on even. And the task force has decided to deal with the problem of working drafts and feedback from the public and even other members of the profession by insisting that everyone participating in the inner circle sign a confidentiality agreement. They're also, by the way, agreeing to limit their conflicts of interest to $10,000 in sponsorship from the drug companies. But we'll get back to that, I think. When they sign this confidentiality agreement, they are agreeing not to circulate beyond the committee even drafts of proposals, working notes, minutes, even votes. So basically, although they're posting a number of sort of statements about developments to a website at the APA, and they're prepared to inform the media with sort of bulletins about what they've agreed upon, the public and actually, psychiatrists also who are just interested in following along are simply unable to establish what has any likelihood of being approved or not as a new disorder. And what might be deleted, that's now in question, I gather, in large part from a sense of public outrage that a number of these issues, such as passive-aggressive personality disorder, is still in this manual. It's still something that could be diagnosed, along with symptoms such as dawdling over doing the laundry. I mean, it's absolutely mind-boggling. In spring 2006, the Washington Post actually determined that every expert working on the DSM criteria for depression had ties to a pharmaceutical company. And more than half of those working on the remaining disorders had similarly compromising ties. So absolutely to what you're saying, the profession has basically generated an insurmountable conflict of interest. And what happens now is that when the FDA, which is this small, overworked federal agency, tries to get outside experts to weigh in on the efficacy of drugs and whether they should be approved for certain disorders, it basically has to presuppose that all of the experts that it consults have ties to so many pharmaceutical companies that, again, the extent of those ties implies a kind of neutrality. So they can't find people who have no conflict of interest. Everyone has a conflict of interest, and therefore that is the basis for presupposing that they'll be disinterested, that they won't be swayed by, say, $1 million of funding for this from this drug company as distinct from a few thousand from that one.
Which is kind of a very Orwellian updating of the whole idea of conflict of interest. And it's related also to just the general trend in the society, which I think is starting to be challenged a little bit now with the new presidency of the, we're talking about a regulatory apparatus that has completely broken down, and it's been the regulation of the medical industry has basically been captured by the people it's supposed to be regulating, the pharmaceutical companies.
Absolutely so.
Christopher, we are just about out of time. Can you give us contact information and your website if people want to find out more and get in touch with you and find out more about your book?
Sure. It's www.christopherlane.org. And people interested in the book will find there a number of interviews that I've given and also short articles that I published in major newspapers describing various areas of the book.
And Christopher, also, don't you have some memos from GlaxoSmithKline that are available on your website?
That's absolutely right. I decided to upload those confidential memos to my website once I realized just what was at stake in psychiatrists denying that Paxil can lead to acute withdrawal symptoms, what they call discontinuation syndrome. GlaxoSmithKline, a year before it pressed for FDA approval of the drug, sent around to its internal executives a memo, confidential, warning that 20% of patients in the trials were experiencing quite severe withdrawal symptoms from the drugs. This is even after 2 weeks. And yet, the drug company nonetheless pressed for and received FDA approval for Paxil as the one antidepressant to treat social anxiety disorder. That was a year later. So it's an extraordinary turnaround. What the BBC investigative program Panorama discovered was that GlaxoSmithKline had masked so much negative data that they basically lied to these pharmaceutical regulators in Britain. And a number of people have described this as a massive cover-up. It's obviously the reason there is a lot of litigation around Paxil. But I felt an ethical responsibility in making those documents available on my website so that people could know that the drug maker itself knew about the problems with Paxil before it pressed for FDA approval.
Christopher Lane, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to an interview with Christopher Lane. Christopher is the author of Shyness: How Normal Behavior Became a Sickness, which is available at your local independent bookseller. He is the Pierce Miller Research Professor of Literature at Northwestern University, and he's the author of several books and the co-editor of Homosexuality and Psychoanalysis and editor of Psychoanalysis of Race. That's all the time we have this week on Madness Radio. Thanks a lot for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. Madness Radio broadcasts every Tuesday, 4 to 5 p.m. Eastern, on Pacifica affiliates WXOJ-LP-FM, Northampton, Massachusetts, and KWMD, Kasilof and Anchorage, Alaska. Co-produced by peer-run mental health communities freedom-center.org and theicarusproject.net. Madness Radio is hosted by Will Hall. Music producer is John Rice, with technical assistance from Jeremy Lansman. Listen to our internet stream, podcasts, and show archives at madnessradio.net. If you have an idea for a story or guest on Madness Radio, to help get us broadcast on a station near you, or if you just want to share what's in your head, contact radio@madnessradio.net. And if you're in Portland, Oregon, be sure to check out portlandhearingvoices.net, support and education for mental diversity, portlandhearingvoices.net.
And that concludes this morning's Radio Zine, the Monday morning Radio Zine for April 6th. Stay tuned now for the noon headlines, and that is followed, as always on Monday by the noontime jamboree. So go nowhere. Stay right here on KBOO Portland.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon. The American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, is threatening potential legal action in an attempt to silence one of its critics, Common Cause. In a cease and desist letter, the right-wing public-private partnership known by its acronym ALEC told Common Cause to stop accusing ALEC of denying climate change. But as Common Cause points out, the text of model legislation by ALEC questions the overwhelming scientific consensus on climate change and tries to minimize the potential impact that climate change will have on the planet. In international news, the Kenyan Air Force has launched airstrikes against Al-Shabaab fighters, who carried out a deadly massacre of university students last week, in which close to 200 students were killed. Al-Shabaab said the attack on the university was revenge for the Kenyan military's involvement in the war in Somalia. The leader of the attack was identified as a law student from the University of Nairobi, who was the son of a chief in Mandera in northern Kenya. He had gone missing and apparently joined Al-Shabaab about a year ago. In response to the attack on the university, Kenyan bombers today dropped airstrikes on two Al-Shabaab camps in the Gedo region of